real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog. Terrific!
I'm Tom Terrific, greatest hero ever. Terrific is the name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and I'm never faithful companion.
Hey, boys, that's me. Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana by Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, where we still sell Ethel. Yeah. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Yeah, well, yesterday I got wrapped up at my dentist. I got to drive about 45 minutes one way to my dentist to get in on my Medicare, my socialized medicine. Yeah, I love it. And so anyhow, that put me a little late. But everything's okay. I didn't have any cavities. How about that? Yeah, just had a cleaning. How about that? They're pearly white, and everybody says, "Look at your teeth, man. You don't need no false teeth." And I say, "Thank you very much. I got a Colgate smile." Oh, but I had a technician. You won't believe it. She was a fox. Tall, slim, blonde, blue-eyed, and I had her right by my kisser for about an hour. Not very romantic, though, I'll tell you that, because she was wearing a mask to make sure I didn't give her AIDS or something. Also, I'm selling a couple of vehicles, a truck and a van out here, and I got them sitting out on the highway with for sale signs on, and I had people calling me all day yesterday to want to go out and see that thing, and I want you to sell it to me for nothing, because I needs it. Well, I had a call in here. Look, don't forget this 641-715-3800 number. Then you put in 56890, and you can leave a message. And I put a message on there about once a week. Sometimes I get behind. But anyhow, I got one this morning from a good friend up there in Detroit City, man. Detroit City. I'll play it for you.
I thought that maybe the Confederate flag being banned by all these companies and venues and, you know, these manufacturers of it could be a cash cow for you or others in the movement. The only source where the Confederate flag come from. I mean, sure, it represents the rich capitalist, the landowners that own the slaves and that, which had nothing really to do with the poor people that joined the ranks of the Confederate Army, but it's also an emblem of fuck you, federal government, you know. Get the fuck back, Jack. Anyways, thought it would be. What else was I going to say? Damn it, I can't think right now. But, give us your opinion of the death of Matt Cole, Matthias Cole, in Milwaukee. The New Order Movement, National Socialism. What can you tell us about the National Alliance? Are they still in business, or are they out of business? Because their phone number isn't working. Just give an update and your opinion about it all. Love to hear from you. Everybody would love to hear about that. If knows anything about that. Well, Pat from Detroit. Keep up the good work, Thomas. God bless you. Good day.
Well, old Pat from Detroit has been calling in here for a long time. It's like not months, but years. And so he's rode out the storm there in Black Detroit. He's still alive. He's still alive. Well, okay, Pat, on the rebel flags, you know, I never was much of a entrepreneur in this thing, trying to couple making money with race. We sell a few things, but not enough to really make a lot of money. And I don't really feel comfortable at this time selling that rebel flag, because there's too many Hanyaks in the right wing that, as far as I'm concerned, are an insult to that flag. And there's a hell of a lot of people sporting that flag that are what I'd consider white trash, too. Now, I know that some people don't like me to use that term, but I mean, there is such a thing. I don't know. Maybe there's another term that's better. I think that Stray Dog mentioned something, but I forget what it was. But anyhow, I see Tom Robb down there in Arkansas and his family. They're all into it. They got a big flag shop and so forth. But I don't know where you're going to be getting these flags from, because probably even the Chinese are going to be pressured into not selling them. I don't know. I haven't really looked around for them. I guess they're not selling them on eBay or Amazon. I don't know. But it might be something someday that someone might want to start a small garage-type business and sew them together, make flags. Because if they get that scarce, there's plenty of right-wingers out there going to want to get them. And I don't think it's that much of a job, or I don't think it takes that much of a seamstress to make a flag, that rebel flag, once you get started and get in the habit of it. So, but anyhow, I don't want to get into it. Okay, now the next question was Matt Kale. Well, as many of you know, and some of you don't know, he was involved with George Lincoln Rockwell and stood to benefit greatly after Rockwell was assassinated, which I don't want to go any farther on that, because I don't have any evidence or proof of anything like that. So, but Matt Kale was a traditional Nazi. He was strictly flags and uniforms, and then also he got the ashes of George Lincoln Rockwell and spirited them off to his own private collection, and then he developed the National Socialist type organization that was strictly a religion. It was the worship of Adolf Hitler and like that, of which I don't believe in worshiping anything and or anybody or anything. So anyhow, I met the man one time at Aryan Nations for about 3 minutes. We talked. He was a quiet guy, didn't say much. He gave a little speech. But so that was the end of many of my conversations with him. I was always open to him contacting me if he wanted to, but he never did. And of course, as I become more less enchanted with this Hitler worship stuff, I'm sure he would not want to talk to me at all anyhow. So I assume he died of natural causes. And that's that. That's all I know about it. National Alliance, I don't know much about that either. They broke up, and Glebe, used to call me once in a while, but tell me all the fractures in the National Alliance. I guess they still got something going there, but I don't hear anything about it. So I can't give you much there. You see, I operate as a lone wolf, independent guy, with a lot of independent lone wolf people. And we don't hang on everything that's happening in this right-wing racial white nationalist or whatever you want to call it cause. Much of it's a waste of time and even money. So what the National Alliance is, what the people are doing with the National Alliance now, I have no idea. So I'm sorry, boys and girls. I'm not very much of an information man today. If you want to tell me everything that everybody's doing briefly, call in on that number and give me a report, 641-715-3800, code 56890. And you can leave a message on there, and I'll play it on the radio show, or just give me the information if you don't want to play it on the radio show. So there you go. I'm sure a lot of you people are more informed about these white nationalists than I am. Well, I see that the Oath Keepers, whatever that means, are showing up at Ferguson. I don't believe in that stuff. I believe in the community's got to stand on its own 2 feet. There's plenty of white people in Ferguson, Missouri. And if they're not willing to go out and protect their property and protect this other white people in the community, or protect simply from violence and burning down stores and everything, well, then they deserve what they get. That's my opinion. Survival of the fittest. If you're not fit, you don't survive. And for guys to come in using it to build their organization, which is just a right-wing thing, and I don't even think they claim to be racist either. I think they claim to be anti-racist, to stand around with their AK-47s or whatever those big guns I saw them with. I think it's a waste of time, and I don't blame the blacks for being upset at it, you know. I don't care who it is, if a bunch of strangers come into your town and standing around with in uniforms and heavy weapons, I think it pisses anybody off, no matter who it is. So I wish those kind of people would stay home and let the thing work its way out the way it's going to work its way out. It's not going to get much better. And they even had a police chief come in from a neighboring town sticking his nose into it. As far as I'm concerned, the blacks wanted to riot, burn the whole damn town down. If the whites don't have the guts or the ability or the balls to take care of the problem, then let it go. That's been my position for a long time. If the white race won't fight, they're going to deserve what they get. I mean, if somebody came into the town where I live next to, raising hell and burning down stuff, I'd be down there doing something about it, or attempting to do something. However, I wouldn't have much in the game, because I live about 3 or 4 miles out of town. They'd say, "Hey, what the hell are you doing down here? You're an outsider." Yeah. You know, I've got an idea. The first guy that gets it to the FBI, I'll probably get paid some money. What I'm thinking of doing is going down to the public library. I've got a beautiful library here, and we've got all kinds of meeting rooms. And I'm thinking of advertising a program to where Tommy reads racism, like I've been doing on the radio show. That once a week, once a month, people are invited to come in there, and I'll be reading out a racial book. About race, which most people don't want to do. Now, it would be interesting to see what's going to happen if that gets out in the paper, which I hope it would. So, and if that's kind of a pilot project worked out pretty good of reaching people, you don't have to ask them to join anything. Just read out of a book for maybe an hour and then go home. You know, their opinion's their opinion. But you could go into libraries all over this country and get a free room and put a little blurb in the paper that on such and such a night for an hour, you're going to be reading white racial material and see what happens. I have no idea what will happen, but I'm thinking of trying it out anyhow. Well, I think it's about time to get back into our book, Terror in the Night, The Klan's Campaign Against the Jews. We've read about 92 pages of this book. So let's get back into it for a while. In their quest for informants, agents sometimes took hair-raising chances. FBI agent Moore arranged for Frank Ford, an Army veteran who had specialized in infiltrating the Chicago underworld, to be transferred to the Jackson office to infiltrate the White Knights, pointing out that the head of the local clavern, Moore told Ford, and I want you to get this guy in your pocket. About a month later, Ford called Moore and said, we're meeting tonight in the Homoshito Forest, both of us stripped to the waist. Well, what about below the waist? I mean, you could put a recording device below the waist, and that's probably why a lot of guys got caught, because they were too bashful just to tell people stripped down all the way. If I had anything that was incriminating to talk about with somebody I don't know, and even somebody I did know, I take them in a room, say strip all the way down, and I would look. I'd be looking for a antenna wire coming out their butt too. That's the way to know. Just think how many guys would not be serving time if they'd have done that, stripped down everybody before they talked to them about anything incriminating. I'm sure that Dennis Mahan wished he had stripped down that gal that was infiltrating. He probably stripped her down, but not when she was wearing the wire. I don't know. What do I know? I don't want any coverage. How in the hell can you cover a Comochito National Forest? I'm not instructing you to do it. If you think you can do it and get away with it, you have my permission. Ford, the Klansman, and the Klansman drove to the forest out crossroads in separate cars, stripped to the waist so that each other could see the other was not armed. Well, yeah, not armed, but what about a recording device? They talked for a half an hour. Next morning, Ford, his new informant, in his pocket. See how easy that was? See how easy that was to get one of the yokels to go along with your program? They met Moore at the King Edward Hotel in Jackson. Moore put the Klan leader on the FBI payroll. There you go. Working with an informant is like milking venom from a rattlesnake, Ford said. You just have to be sure you don't turn the head loose. The FBI's campaign to penetrate the Klan was so intense that throughout the South, Klan leaders complained about informants. Well, of course. What do you think they're going to do? What do you think the government's going to do? What do you think the FBI's going to do if you're running a program against them? If you're running a real white separatist outfit, they're going to spend a fortune just to infiltrate you. The FBI's campaign to penetrate the Klan was so intense that throughout the South, Klan leaders complained about informants. In Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Imperial Wizard Robert Shelton, of which I've known personally, Robert Shelton, of the United Klans of America, became so jittery that he proposed using lie detectors and truth drugs to ferret out any informants. Well, he was one of the smarter guys that was in the Klan. And when I met him in Norborn, Missouri, at Robert Depew's place, the head of the Minutemen, he had his lie detectors there, and he had a Winnebago. He would take guys out there and put them on the lie detector machine. And don't kid yourself, a good operator can find about 95% of the problem, maybe a little more. Anybody that says they don't work at all doesn't know what they're talking about, because I used one for years, and I exposed two or three people at least. He said one night when he first got the lie detectors, he would go to these meetings unannounced and just show up, come to the door, come inside. Well, tonight's the night, boys. You got to take a lie detector test. And he said one night a guy went right through a plate glass window and ran all the way down the road to get away. Robert Shelton was pretty sharp. He was an airplane pilot, too. He used modern techniques. The only place where he screwed up was when Dees went after him and he folded. And that's what led Dees to me. If Dees had been stopped when he went after Shelton in court, I don't think he would have ever tried to come after me. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Jack Helms, Imperial Wizard of the United Universal Clans of America, raged bitterly about the informers after appearing before a Paris County grand jury investigating the bombing of the home of Victor Boussy, president of the Louisiana AFL-CIO. That's a little strange. Helms denied an informant's testimony that he had ordered Boussy's home bombed and told reporters, quote, "I'm just tired of these informers." What? Tired? You're going to get them whether you like it or not. I don't know how many may be in my organization. I can't even do my work. Well, if you had proper security and had intelligence enough, you would have taken care of it. It's not that hard to expose an informant. I've done it several times. Developing informants and writing suspects hard was standard police work, but the FBI went a significant step further in its campaign when Hoover authorized a counterintelligence program. September 2nd, 64, COINTELPRO memo that he sent to the FBI offices throughout the country emphasized the secret nature of the program and expressed concern that public exposure of it would be embarrassing. Well, they used all kinds of tricks under COINTELPRO. It's still out there. I don't think they call it COINTELPRO anymore, but you can be sure that they've got a similar program. September 2nd, 64, COINTELPRO memo that he sent to the FBI offices throughout the country emphasized the secret nature of the program and expressed concern that public exposure of it would be embarrassing. Well, it would be, because they used all kinds of unconstitutional and really illegal actions. But, you know, who cares? The whole government had been put on notice to go after the Klan any way that they saw fit. In the same way now, if you're going to be activist and be effective, forget any kind of constitutional protections. That's bullshit. The Constitution's been dead since the Civil War anyhow, for Christ's sake. The purpose of this program is to expose, disrupt, and otherwise neutralize the activities of various clans and hate organizations. Their leadership and adherents. That means just people who are friends of them. Not the just members, but anybody. The devious maneuvers and duplicity of these groups must be exposed to the public scrutiny through the cooperation of reliable news media, both locally and at the seat of government. The duplicity of the Klan groups? Are you kidding? They were far more honest than the government and the FBI. In every instance, consideration should be given to disrupting the organized activity of these groups, and no opportunity should be missed to capitalize upon organizational and personal conflicts in their leadership. They used to send, I think he'll cover this pretty soon, they used to send fake letters to Klansmen that their wives were screwing some other Klan member. And vice versa, they used to do that all the time, just to cause trouble. The Bureau considers it vital that we expose the identities and activities of such groups, and where possible, disrupt their efforts. In other words, their program for supporting the white race. No counterintelligence action may be initiated in the field without specific Bureau authorization. You are cautioned that the nature of this new endeavor is such that under no circumstances should the existence of the programs be made known outside the Bureau, and appropriate within-office security should be afforded this sensitive operation. Well, it was sensitive because half or three-quarters of it was illegal. And they had the news media in it with them, too. I know that. I remember when they were, when they admitted that the CIA and the FBI had used news reporters as agents. And they still do. This new counterintelligence effort will take advantage of our experience with a variety of sophisticated techniques, successfully applied against the Communist Party USA and related organizations since 1956. Well, the Communist Party USA was never a threat to this country. People didn't like the communists, but some of the things the communists said were correct, you know. But they were never a threat. But this is they were used by the FBI to build their own organization and get more money from Congress. The FBI offices were instructed to develop compromise-type data on immorality, dishonesty, and devious tactics related to Sam Bowers and other Klan leaders. In other words, get something on them. They're stepping out on their wife or whatever it happens to be. Mature, experienced agents should be utilized, and any investigation conducted should be done in a most discreet manner, in other words, secret manner, in order to avoid any possibility of embarrassment to the Bureau. We wouldn't want the famous but incompetent exposed in their illegal activity and immoral activity, and J. Edgar Hoover's immoral activity. Some elements of the COINTELPRO were entirely legal, if unorthodox, such as providing information on the Klan to reporters for use in stories in order to show the Klansmen how much the Bureau knew about their supposedly secret activities. But some of the COINTELPRO tactics skirted the edge of the law. No, they were outright illegal. And others were illegal. Agents frequently gathered compromising information through wiretaps, financial statements, and tax records. Sometimes the information was used to compel or blackmail Klansmen into cooperating with FBI investigations. Often it was used merely to sow mistrust and bad feelings among Klan units. They do that in the right wing. They always have. They're doing it today. That's how you get all these organizations fighting each other and different leaders fighting each other and so forth. And they always make sure they've got a man in the leadership of every membership organization. Don't tell me they don't do it. They sure as hell do. An FBI memo targeting Bowers and other Klan leaders dated May 15, 1965 declared, quote, "We are endeavoring as a counterintelligence technique to develop information discrediting or embarrassing to them and the Ku Klux Klan. Through analysis of their income tax returns, we may be able to determine whether or not sources of their income or depositories used by them for their respective Klan organizations are legitimate." Let me remind you, anybody's got tax exemption, you can get their tax records. You don't have to have some organization do it. I got all the tax records on Morris Dees years ago and uncovered where he was taking tremendous amounts of money in. He took $7 million in donations off my trial. $7 million. And the black guy that got killed up there, his family got peanuts. And also we discovered where he was stashing his money. And that was called the Southern Front or Southern something. And when I called the state of Alabama's department that had to do with those kind of deposits, they never heard of this outfit. And I put it out, but nobody picked up on it. As far as I know, they're still using this phony drop for all their money. I don't know. I don't give a shit about these anymore. May he die a horrible sexual death. COINTELPRO got almost instant results a year after it was initiated. Assistant Director A.H. Belmont, head of the FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division, secretly notified the Johnson administration that the program had been instrumental in solving 5 Klan murders. Well, if they'd have done it right, they wouldn't have solved them. The killings of Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney at Philadelphia. The slaying of Viola LaRusso, well, she was slain by an FBI informant. What was his name? I used to be very familiar with his name. I may think of it before the show's over. He was in the car. He was one of the gunmen when they pulled up beside her and her black friends. He's the one that did the shooting. Gary Rowe, that was his name. Gary Rowe is pretty well proven to have been the trigger man in the Viola LaRusso killing, but he never was investigated and never did a day in jail. So if you're an FBI informant or an FBI agent or an FBI contract agent, you can get away with murder, no problem. She was killed in the aftermath of the Selma to Montgomery Voting Rights March in March 65. And the shotgun death of Colonel Lemuel Penn in July 64 near Madison, Georgia. Actually, I consider most of these people that the Klan did get as low-level people and not really that important, other than spreading fear. I've never agreed with that street-level operation. Belmont wrote that the FBI was seizing every opportunity to disrupt the activities of the Klan organizations, and that nearly 2,000 of our informants and sources are being operated to obtain up-to-date intelligence regarding racial matters. Of those, 774 have been developed in the past year. 774! Oh, man. I think almost everybody in the Klan groups were informants or agents. That's why membership organizations cannot be trusted, cannot be used. I mean, you can use them, but if you step out of line at all, they're going to grab you. The next day, Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach, oh, that son of a bitch, I remember him, wrote a letter to Hoover congratulating the FBI on its progress in solving civil wrongs cases and recognizing the need to keep a lid on its COINTELPRO tactics. Well, yeah, because if a lot of constitutional lawyers had known everything that they were doing, they would have been held to pay. It is unfortunate, Katzenbach wrote, that the value of these activities would, in most cases, be lost if too extensive publicity were given to them. Yeah, right. However, perhaps at some point it may be possible to place these achievements on the public record. Oh, yeah, right. So that the Bureau can receive due credit. Yeah. While Moore presided over an institutional transformation of the FBI in Mississippi, Alvin Binder underwent a profound personal transformation. Wow. Shortly after the Korean War, when Binder moved to Jackson with his first wife, he was a struggling young lawyer, eager to rise and prepare to do whatever it took to win approval. He was a Jew. He was also a segregationist. And he was so deeply immersed in Mississippi's assimilation-minded Jewish community that 2 decades passed before the anomaly of his position occurred to him. Living in an overwhelmingly white, predominantly Baptist society, Binder did his best not to look at himself as a Jew at all. Articulate, ego-driven, fast on his feet in a courtroom, willing to take on tough political tasks in order to get ahead, he considered himself first the foremost a Mississippian. He firmly defended the state's values and traditions, including its system of racial segregation and white supremacy. Mississippi's rulers in the 50s and 60s expected nothing less, but Binder embraced segregation willingly. He liked to point out that a Jew, Judah P. Benjamin, was the Secretary of War in the Confederate cabinet, that 158 Jewish soldiers served in the Confederate units in Mississippi, and that Jews fought against one another just as Christians against one another in what Binder said, like most Southerners, called the war between the states. Religion had never been important to Binder when he was growing up. He knew he was a Jew, and most of the people he was acquainted with knew he was too. That was enough Jewish identity for him. When he attended Gulf Coast Military Academy, a high school in Gulfport, there was no synagogue in the area. He He often attended services at a Baptist Bible school. Sometimes he went to Catholic Mass. His best friend was a Catholic. Well, you know, Judaism, Catholicism, Protestantism, they're joined at the hip. I mean, you know, the whole Old Testament is the Torah, for Christ's sake. He experienced very little anti-Semitism until he attended Tulane University in New Orleans. There he was invited to pledge Phi Delta Theta, but the invitation was withdrawn when officers of the fraternity learned he was Jewish. See, this is as highbrow anti-Semitism, you know, among the rich and famous, you know, the ruling class. They play these little games and they have these groups and clubs and things like that, and they didn't want Jews involved. At least the hierarchy didn't, but it wasn't really anything with teeth in it. It hurt, he recalled later, but he took comfort in knowing he had never been called a dirty Jew to his face or subjected to other anti-Semitic insults of the kind he had read about. The University of Mississippi, where he went to law school, he blended in with the majority. Well, if he was white-skinned and looked European, hold it. Another car buyer on the phone. These guys want a brand-new car for $500. Flawless and run perfect. Some of these people are pretty dumb. I'm afraid our white working class is getting dumber all the time. Okay, back to the book. Binder's ambition when he settled in Jackson was to make enough money to build a spacious antebellum home and live like a southern squire. Sure. And play the pro-segregation thing. Fly under the radar and all that kind of stuff. Which many Jews do. By 62, he had accomplished it. He and his novelist wife, Paige Mitchell, an attractive brunette, moved into a two-story, five-bedroom brick colonial with columns made of California redwood. With 4,000 square feet of living space, it had a 47-foot living room and a den to match. Standing on a corner lot in a tree-shaded upper-middle-income area, it was a neighborhood showplace. In addition, Binder bought two adjoining wooded lots to provide privacy and a magnificent setting for the home he intended to occupy for the rest of his life. Pretending to be a southern segregationist, white racist. Well, in fact, in his mind, he probably was. I guess you can quit being a Jew. I mean, if you're physically of the Jew look and act, it's pretty hard. But there's a lot of assimilated type Jews that come in here from Germany, and they don't have that Semitic, Asiatic look. I guess they can quit being a Jew. I resigned from the Talmud. Don't come around here no more. Neither Binder nor other Jews could belong to the Jackson Country Club, even though Isidore Dreyfus. Now remember, this is about religion. This is not about race. This is about religion, the Christian churches, because that was back when they were all excited that the Jews killed Jesus. Of course, if you listen to me or not, you'll know that they couldn't have killed Jesus because Jesus never existed. And it's sort of a cosmic joke that here is these Jews are blamed for murdering God. He never existed. To me, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. And what a terrible thing on these Jews. Now, they get into trouble, do all kinds of bad stuff. The Jews are into all kinds of skullduggery, but the one thing that they didn't do is the one that they get blamed for the most. And, of course, that's why, in most cases, they weren't allowed into these so-called Christian, I call them Christian Zionist churches, because they were, anyhow, it's a riot to me. Neither Binder nor other Jews could belong to the Jackson Country Club. Of course, you remember what the comedian said. What was his name? Marx. Not Karl Marx, but the one that's on television, or used to be on television. His famous statement, I wouldn't want to be a member of a club that didn't want me. I agree on that. If I go in a place and people are not friendly to me and don't like me, I just leave. Piss on them. I don't care. One of the most prominent Jews in Jackson, he had donated the land for the club many years earlier when Jews were still welcome. Well, that's interesting. He donated the land for the country club, and now he couldn't even belong to it. I don't blame him for being pissed off. Jews were also excluded from the Junior League. Oh, boy. And certain other civic organizations. Well, I am too. I can't get... The Republicans don't want me. The Democrats don't want me. Most of the clubs don't want me. So what should I cry in my beer? Piss on them. But those were minor annoyances. Jews were excluded from private clubs throughout the country, not just in Mississippi. And if a Jew had the money and the will, he could find a way around some of these obstacles. After Binder's daughter Lisa was blackballed from the Girl Scout troop at 62, he paid to have another Girl Scout unit formed and would accept her as a member. Why didn't they form a Jew Girl Scout group? Well, there probably wasn't enough Jews to maintain it. You know, if somebody don't like you, well, then go do your own thing, okay? The Yiddish Girl Scouts, there you go. The 140 or so Jewish families in Jackson in the 1960s were otherwise so well assimilated into the community that there was considerable social mingling with Gentiles. See, that's the same thing that went on in Germany and all over the place. The Binders were considered part of the Jewish community's social elite because his success in the courtroom and Paige Mitchell's reputation as a writer. Upon publication of her well-received novel, A Wilderness of Monkeys, the Hinds County lawyer's wife sent out subpoenas as invitations to the luncheon at which she was honored. I might look up that book sometime. You might want to read it and see if it's any good. A Wilderness of Monkeys by Paige Mitchell, who obviously was probably not Jewish. These Jew boys like those shishkas, those non-Jew women. Because you know how the Jew women are. Well, at least that's what I've heard.
Abraham, you go do this. Abraham, do that. Abraham.
So Abraham goes out and finds himself a quiet, white, non-Jewish woman. And then she divorces him and takes everything he's got, quietly. Binder moved up in the political world, too. He became an advisor and speechwriter for the Mayor Alan Thompson. Undisturbed, you know, they love to be aides like that. Aides to congressmen, aides to senators, speechwriters. But now they're coming right out in the open. It used to be that way, but now, hell, they're coming right out there. They're in the driver's seat now, baby. He became an advisor and speechwriter. Oh, I read that. In dealing with civil rights demonstrators, the Jackson police used a specially equipped armored car, commonly known as the Thompson Tank. Boy, this was way back when. It had portals for machine guns and space enough for 12 armed men. Oh, I'd like to have that. During the Freedom Rides in 1961, Jackson authorities hired Binder to prosecute the demonstrators who were arrested on charges of violating local breach of peace ordinances. Well, that must mean he prosecuted a lot of Jews, because as I read to you earlier, about 50% of the people involved in the civil wrongs marches were Jews. And that's what they said. Don't blame me. I didn't say it. They said it. He undertook the assignment with enthusiasm, and he accepted an invitation that year from Governor Johnson to make pro-segregation speeches in the North on behalf of the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, whose covert operations were down-home versions of COINTELPRO. Oh! Talk about a mixed-up situation. The Mississippi legislature had created the Sovereignty Commission in 1956, 2 years after Brown v. Board of Education, to preserve segregation in the face of court-ordered school desegregation. With funds appropriated by the legislature, the commission hired spies, blacks and whites, to infiltrate civil wrongs organizations and report on their activities and any subversive connections. You know, I hate snitches. I always did, always will. I'm sorry. Practically all of the commission's activities were aimed at blacks and civil rights, civil wrongs activists. It investigated the and compiled dossiers on hundreds of people, including teachers, ministers, and students, and it brought pressure and cost some people their jobs. I'm sure it did. Any people get that kind of power in their files, they're going to use, somebody's going to use it for bad reasons, no matter which side you're on. Well, it's like NASA is today. They got a big file. On one occasion, a commission investigator even spied on 300 Jew teenagers attending a five-state B'nai B'rith youth meeting at the Sun and Sand Motel in Biloxi. The commission memo, not unearthed until many years later, disclosed that the investigation came up empty-handed. Quote, "These youth sang songs and a general party atmosphere prevailed. We observed them and listened to them, but we could observe nothing or hear nothing that indicated they were advocating subversion, integration, or anything of a communistic nature," unquote. On the whole, the Sovereignty Commission ignored Mississippi's Jewish community because it was relatively small and correctly considered to be as segregation as the rest of the white population. You get that? You hear that? On the whole, the Sovereignty Commission ignored Mississippi's Jewish community because it was relatively small and correctly considered to be as segregation as the rest of the white population. The perception was reinforced by Binder's decision to speak on behalf of the commission. He spoke in several northern cities on the virtues of the Southern way of life, accusing the press of distorting Mississippi's image. I don't ever see the ADL coming up with calling this guy historically bad names, nasty guy, hater. Huh? You suppose it was because he was a Jew they covered it up later? Certainly there were racial problems in Mississippi, just as there were in other states, Binder told the exchange clubs, Rotary clubs, and other civic organizations. But Mississippians would solve their own problems if outside agitators would stay away. The outsiders were only complicating a complex social problem. Binder contended Mississippi had made so much progress in eliminating discrimination that any disadvantages Negroes faced resulted from past policies. Speaking and the fact that white people just don't want to be around them, goddammit. Speaking for the commission at a joint meeting of the Rotary Lions and Kiwanis clubs in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Binder the Jew insisted that Mississippi assesses Negroes as individuals, not as a race, and is doing all within its power to overcome the culture lag resulting from the sinning by whites in the past. Segregation, of course, is sinning. If you don't believe the blacks and the whites are equal, then you're a bad man. On one occasion, accompanied by Mike Martinson, a public relations staffer for the commission, Binder was in St. Louis to address a pro-segregation rally at a Masonic lodge. Ooh, the Masons! They were picked up at the airport by a driver who shocked them by declaring, "We got to do something about the niggers and the Jews and the Catholics." Binder and Martinson, a Catholic, thought they had better find out what kind of organization had invited Binder. They contacted an editor of St. Louis Post-Dispatch and got another shock. They were scheduled to attend a Ku Klux Klan rally. "Oh my God," Binder said, "they don't like Jews either, and they don't like Catholics. But I can't believe the Sovereignty Commission would schedule me to speak to a Klan rally." He and Martinson prudently arrived at the Masonic Temple before the rally was scheduled to begin so they could scout out the situation. Standing on the sidewalk outside the temple and handing out pamphlets as their taxi pulled up was a man dressed in a white robe and hood. Binder instructed their cab driver to take them back to the hotel. You see, these guys can be pro-segregationists, but they all wanted to hate the Klan. They returned to Jackson on the first flight they could arrange. A chastened Binder told the Sovereignty Commission he would not be making any more speeches under its sponsorship. He never made another one. The St. Louis trip was the first of a series of experiences that made him begin to re-examine the nature of Mississippi society and his place in it. For a time, while divorcing himself from the extremism of the Sovereignty Commission, he continued to support segregation. Two encounters in the early 60s called even that support into question. Both grew out of the Freedom Riders, campaign to desegregate interstate travel, which had made the Mississippi capital a focal point. In other words, they couldn't segregate people on the buses or trains and like that. You know, all the time, you know, all the other stuff they were worried about at the time, what, Korean War, stuff like that, all kinds of world problems. And they're worried that this is the way you draw people's attention away from a real problem onto a ha-ha problem. And that's what they do all the time. They do it every day, the system. Binder had befriended William Kunstler. Oh, that son of a bitch. I debated him. While the civil wrongs lawyer was in Jackson. Accounts of Kunstler, and he was a communist. Kunstler was a communist. Accounts of Kunstler's defense of Freedom Riders in Jackson Clarion Ledger and the Jackson Daily News had stirred such hostility among whites that Kunstler was afraid to leave his room in the Sun and Sand Motel to eat dinner, and Binder had taken food to the lawyer's room. Well, that's good. He was scared shitless. Later, the two sat together on a flight from Jackson to New Orleans. Kunstler asked Binder if he knew much about the work of Martin Luther King. When Binder said he did not, Kunstler gave him several pamphlets describing King's tactics and their roots in Gandhi's principles of nonviolence, which is bullshit. That whole concept of nonviolence is created to cause violence, you see. It's one of the easiest ways of promoting violence through nonviolence. If you don't understand that, think about it. Martin Luther King is one of the few Negroes who believes in nonviolence, and you better pray nothing happens to him, Kunstler said. Well, he did believe in violence, except he promoted it in a different way. Binder said nothing, but began thumbing through the pamphlets. Finally, Kunstler broke the silence. Someday you ought to get off your damn knees and stand up like a man and do something. Al Binder, you're not doing a damn thing. People like you are doing nothing about the racial injustices down here. Only us northern Jews are doing that. Binder flinched as though he had been slapped in the face. Then he yelled at Kunstler, startling the other passengers. You're only saying these things to me because I'm Jewish. You must be anti-Semitic, you Jew. Kunstler would not say those things to a Christian or a non-Jew. Binder thought, why was it okay to say something like that to a member of a minority to demand that he stand up and do something? Binder had an even more unsettling encounter with King himself. In the period from December 12th to December 16th, 1961, a total of 737 blacks, including King, were arrested and jailed in Albany, Georgia, as a result of massive demonstrations supporting nine Freedom Riders who were on trial there for sitting in the white waiting room of the city's central of Georgia Railroad Station. The city had tried to squelch the demonstrations with mass arrest, but the tactic threatened to backfire. Well, it was the law. See, everybody gets all upset with these people that arrest these people, but that was the law at the time was the law, and it was segregationist. King refused to be released on bond after his arrest and said he would stay in the jail during the Christmas as a symbol of protest. Albany Mayor Asa Kelly was desperate to keep his city from becoming a major civil wrongs battleground, especially over the holidays. He telephoned Mayor Thompson in Jackson and asked for help, knowing Thompson had a great deal of experience dealing with demonstrations. Could he send someone to advise the city on how to handle a situation? Mayor Thompson said to ask Binder to go to Albany. Binder wondered why he was being called on, but agreed to go. In Albany, Mayor Kelly gave him carte blanche to negotiate. At the jail, Binder found King clad in a blue denims he usually wore in protest marches, sitting on the floor of his small cell. The civil wrongs leader was alone. Binder introduced himself, and King stood up and shook his hand. "I've come to help you get out of here," Binder said. "I've got the power to walk out of there and tell them to let you go. All you've got to do is agree to leave town and go back to Atlanta." The sudden offer startled King. He hesitated and then said firmly, "I'm here to stay." Binder asked why. "Because this is a part of my passive resistance to unfair and unconstitutional actions that have been devastating my people." King spoke in a pleasant voice but refused to budge from his position. They discussed the matter for about 20 minutes. Finally, King shook Binder's hand and thanked him for coming by. Binder was moved by the experience. It occurred to him that the South would be facing both civil wrongs protests and King's influence for a long time, and so far it had not found an honorable way of confronting them. The thought made him uneasy about continuing to participate in the system, even though he had been raised within it, had defended it, and believed in it. He was starting to think that as a young lawyer he should find a way to distance himself from segregation, but he was not sure how to do it. Well, that's the same thing with Morris Dees. See, the first time there was an attack on the Freedom Bus Riders down there in Montgomery, Dees went to work for the Klan. A lot of people still don't know that. But when he saw that the Klan didn't have hardly any money, and there was not hardly any money to be raised, he quit and flipped over on the other side. So, not long after his return from Albany, Binder was called upon to prosecute a group of protesters. He did it, but with little enthusiasm and less pride in the guilty verdict he won. Minutes after the trial, he saw three of the jurors walk out of Mayor Thompson's office. He knew instinctively that the verdict had been preordained, the conviction improper. The jurors had gone to the mayor's office to report the verdict and to be congratulated. Binders resigned from the prosecution's office that afternoon. That experience was part of what drove him to become active in the Temple Beth Israel congregation. He even became friendly with Rabbi Nussbaum, though he still considered him too liberal for Jackson and too involved in ministering to the civil wrongs protesters. Even so, when Nussbaum wanted to visit several young Episcopal ministers who had been arrested in the demonstrations, Binder arranged for him to slip into the Jackson jail through a back door at night so his visits would not create problems for him or his congregation. Binder said later that his visits with King and Kunstler, along with his experience as a speaker for the Sovereignty Commission and as a prosecutor of Freedom Riders, so-called, were important elements in the change that occurred in his attitude on race and civil rights, civil wrongs. "I began to see the South was going to have this problem with us for a good period of time. I felt that as a young person, I could not continue to be involved in the Southern conservative view, even though I had been born and raised with these prejudices. I had not looked at myself as a Jew until then. I had looked at myself as an up-and-coming young lawyer anxious to be approved by the establishment and ego-oriented around the fact that the establishment was using my articulateness to participate in things that I had not really looked into too well." In other words, I started seeing the grass was greener on the other side of the fence, and I had a lot better future going along with the civil wrongs movement. The transformation of Al Binder, like the reshaping of the FBI in the South, was a gradual process. by the fall of 1967 with the bombing of the Jackson Synagogue and Rabbi Nussbaum's house, Binder, Reformation, and Moore's rebuilding of the Jackson Field Office had gone far enough to permit the two men to enter into a potent alliance. The scene of the action was about to shift away from Jackson. A host of new players would surge onto the stage. And that's it for today. We've gone hours past, and so we're ready to go. And I'll be back tomorrow, and let's continue with this. It's a pretty exciting book, I think. Been a long time since I read it, so I hope you enjoy it too. It gives you a lot better idea of all kinds of things: infiltration, subversion, all kinds of stuff, keeping people out of organizations and country clubs, and how they play ball to make money and all that kind of stuff. When things get going rough, they switch sides, and there's all kinds of that stuff. You read between the lines or listen between the lines of what I'm saying, okay? 14:05. Be back tomorrow. And tomorrow is Thursday already. Boy, these weeks go fast. Once you get past Tuesday, they just zip. They zip. Incidentally, I used to wonder about Matt Cale, Matthias Cale, the head of this Nazi party. He was very dark-complected and dark-eyed and one of the ways I pretty much determine race is, number one, you got to have light eyes. If you got black eyes, if your pupils are black, that's the first sign you're dealing with someone from another darker race. That's the way I look at it. What do you think?
Cheer up, Ron. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Aye. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Available in the foyer. Someone's got to live as well, man. Huh? Big place.
foolish rubbish.
Oh!